Welcome to episode 3 of Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith, and I thought it'd be good to just start with a few words from me on why I'm choosing to cover this topic. Because that's the big question on everybody's mind, right? What is this guy going to tell me to think about the Bible? And the answer is nothing. The Bible's a fascinating book, no matter what you think about it. Whether you think it's the infallible word of God, or whether you think it's whether you don't believe in God at all. It doesn't matter, because if nothing else, the Bible has been instrumental in the origins of many of the world's leading nations. And also because of the state of the world right now, there's so much talk of religion. You know, the world is up in arms over this. I think urbanization is playing a big part as people flock to big cities, and we're being forced to reconcile our worldviews within very close quarters. And so I think everyone has a vested interest in this topic, no matter what you believe. And feel free to listen at ease, because I'm not going to try to convince you to be a Christian or an atheist or anything. The goal of this conversation is to learn. And so without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Richard Elliott Friedman, one of the world's leading minds on the Old Testament and the author of the best-selling work on the origins of it, Who Wrote the Bible, as well as The Bible with Sources Revealed and The Exodus. Put on your thinking caps.
So I'm fighting this terrible urge to make milk jokes. I just want you to know this.
Hey, you know, we can make as many milk jokes as necessary. For those not following, he's referencing an old video of mine called Milk. The joke of the video is how many different ways people pronounce the word milk.
See, it's a thing in my field. Everybody there would get it. The word for king in Hebrew. In biblical times, it was pronounced Malk, and we write it M-A-L-K.
No joke.
And in some of the other Canaanite languages, it's a big debate, because there are no vowels in the ancient languages, only consonants. So there's a big debate
right.
over whether they pronounce the word for king Malk or milk.
So that is hilarious.
Everything that everybody else experiences out of that one, plus a level.
That is definitely a first for me. I've never heard that reaction to it. We're here today with Dr. Richard Elliott Friedman. You've told me I can call you Dick, but I'm going to intro you properly. I discovered your book, Who Wrote the Bible, randomly in a library recently, and I tore it apart in six sittings, something like that. Really fast, I tore through it.
And I didn't get any royalties. Then,
you didn't get any royalties.
Library copy.
That's true, yeah.
I can live with it.
I basically pirated it, mm-hmm. basically stole it. And now I'm reading your new book, The Exodus, on a PDF on my laptop. I haven't paid you a dime.
It's our pleasure.
And now I'm drinking your beer. This deal just keeps getting better. But I really am so thankful that I discovered that book, because for me it was just a huge perspective shift going from, you know, living in a place where in the South people read the Bible a very specific way. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but, you know, when it comes to the melting pot that all of our countries are becoming, you know, how you read the Bible becomes very important. And so this book, Who Wrote the Bible, that you wrote is, you know, has been really amazing. And I've been kind of starting to read The Exodus, which is now a sequel of sorts, as I understand, right? It's kind
in
of a follow-up. It's
yeah.
a follow-up.
Yeah.
But 30 years later in the making. So today I want to talk about the documentary hypothesis, because I understand that's the favorite amongst scholars. But just, you know, all things the Bible.
Okay.
The documentary hypothesis says that the Bible, especially the Old Testament, is a collection of documents, poetry, record keeping, history, kind of all jumbled together. You know, it was redacted at several different times. And ultimately, the Old Testament is four different sources, which we call E, J, D, and P. And each of those sources contributed to the Old Testament at different times for different political reasons and writing about things that were important to them as tribes. And over the years, as people fled Israel and were exiled and then came back, Israel kind of became its own melting pot. And all these tribes that were once different and separated and believed different things, they were all coming together and had to kind of believe the same thing as one nation. And so for unity's sake, they edited together all these different books, which had once existed independently to make up what we now have in the Old Testament. Is that more or less right, or did I butcher it completely?
That's pretty darn good. The E and J, the four main sources, those are really just in the first five books of the Bible. And then it gets more and more complicated as you get through. I mean, there's 39 books in the Old Testament, and nobody agrees on any one of them.
Right.
That it's by, even the book of Obadiah is one page long, and we think it's by two different people. So, you know, scholars. You
a
know,
really lazy
don't get
writer.
Us started, you know. Yeah.
Is there any indicator that what we're reading in the Old Testament is folklore or parables? since, you know, the cultures they came from were originally oral traditions, and that's how these stories survived for a long time. So, you know, and then the idea that the P source, the priestly source, came much later once Judaism started kind of evolving into an official religion, and that's when it would have kind of started changing. And now you're shaking your head at me and I'm doubting everything I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, I've always argued that even the earliest ones, like E and J, mm-hmm. Those and the Court History of David, which is the book of 2 Samuel now, those were the first prose writing on earth. And it's amazing that it's so good that we got it so right the first time out. I mean, there may have been 1,000 books written before that that we just don't have, that didn't survive. But the oldest books we have, the first history writing on earth, is those sources. So that's why you saw me jump a little when I hear, like, it's not exactly folklore, and it's not pagan. They're monotheistic. Hmm. But they were brilliant writers when, until then, nobody had written anything but poetry. I mean, you ask people, which do you think humans wrote first, prose or poetry? I don't know, but I'm guessing most people instinctively would say, well, we wrote prose first and then poetry, which is wrong by about 2,000 years. I mean, for a couple thousand years, people wrote everything. All the earliest works known, like Gilgamesh epic and all those, were poetry. And the first prose ever was written by these guys. I was taught in college that Herodotus was the father of history, but the J and E and the Court History were written when Herodotus's great-grandmother wasn't in preschool yet. You know, it was really early.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's brilliant writing. It's extraordinary, really.
Okay, so maybe I misunderstood that part of your book. You're saying it wasn't polytheistic paganism that Judaism evolved from, because they had all these different names for God. They were calling him El, they were calling him Elohim, they were calling him Yahweh, and there were tons of names before that from when polytheism was rampant in the area before that. So what was I missing there?
Yeah, that's my fault, because it took me 30 years to clarify that. So it's in the new book, The Exodus, that I clarify that better. A lot of people thought that originally, that these different authors of the Bible could be pulled out because some will refer to God by his name, Yahweh, and others refer to him as God, which in Hebrew is Elohim. That's where we got the J and the E. But it's not that God has different names to different authors. It's that different ideas of when God revealed his name to humans. And so in a couple of the sources, God is only called El or Elohim, which just means God, or it's a name, El, of a God, all through Genesis. And they never use his name. Whereas the other source calls him Yahweh right from the beginning. The others have it that God didn't reveal his name until the generation of Moses and the Exodus. And what's new now is I say, well, that's interesting. Why the Exodus? Why didn't somebody say God first made his name known to Abraham or to Adam or to anybody before that? And the hypothesis is that not all of Israel was in the Exodus. The Exodus was historical, but it was only one group, which I think was the Levites, or, you know, one of the groups in ancient Israel, and they worshipped the God Yahweh. And then they arrive in Israel. They eventually become the priests of Israel, which they are the clergy to this day. And they meet the Israelites who are all worshiping a god named El. I mean, they come from a country called Israel. I mean, Yisrael means, you know, it was part of their name. It's who they worship. So they had to make a decision. They say, well, we're going to merge now into one people. Are we going to worship Yahweh, or are we going to worship El? Or are we going to worship both? In which case they would have been a duotheism, a bitheism, a two-theism, whatever.
But not poly, because it was only two.
Only two.
Okay, so I guess the question I have is, when they decided that El and Elohim and Yahweh, all these different gods, were going to be the same God from there on out, did they really think it was the same God? Or was it just a creative way for them to try to put their differences aside and merge their tribes?
It's a great question, and you know when somebody says it's a great question, it means they don't know the answer. So watch very carefully. You're about to see a scholar say those words. You have to practice to be able to do this. I don't know. I mean, how can I know what was in their minds? I only know what they wrote. And what they wrote was, these two gods are one. And they wrote it everywhere. It's virtually unanimous in the whole Old Testament. And of course, by the New Testament, it's a done deal already. So I think they meant it and took it seriously. at least the priests or the prophets, the ones who were teaching it. The masses weren't buying this. It took centuries before the masses gave up all the gods. Even if they accepted Yahweh, but they still had all the others too. And there was always, apparently till very late in the biblical world, a goddess in that picture too, because they couldn't picture this deity who was definitely male without a
He needs a lady
consort.
Friend. He needs a lady friend.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because we need lady friends.
That's basically it.
If there's a God, he's like us, right?
Yeah. I mean, you go, well, I have a wife. Why would God not? I mean, why in that world?
What kind of God wouldn't want a lady?
Absolutely. Pagan gods, as you know, we're getting a lot of action. And your God is, I mean, would just be mocked by the pagans.
My God, never gets laid.
That's right.
You know, one of the things that I've always appreciated about your perspective since I've been reading your work is when I read who wrote the Bible, and I would assume that this was your goal all along, when I read it, I had no idea what your personal view was. I still don't really know what your personal view is, but that's what I love about it, because when you're looking for what exists out there, information-wise on this subject, there's a lot of opinions and not much hard, cold facts about what actually exists. And so I found it really refreshing reading your book. It didn't really make me feel pushed to think one specific way or the other, but just reading the information that was there. And it seemed like you're pretty clear when there isn't an answer, you don't act like you have an answer. And I like that. You were always very clear, like nobody really knows the answers to these things, but on this specific subject, here's where the divide is. And I liked that.
I think it was because my first job after I graduated was at UC San Diego, which is a real hard science school. I mean, they're known for engineering and physics and chemistry, and they had all these Nobel Prize winners. And people like me in the humanities, the social sciences, were treated like poor relatives there. You know, we were accepted, but, you know. But what I learned was tremendous respect for scientific method and trying to say to my physicist colleagues, well, what I do is the same as what you do. I look at evidence and form hypotheses and I test them. And you know, and all I have is the text and archaeology. So I have two sources of evidence and that's what I do. And so when you read my books, I hope it comes across that way. Yeah, that I'm just going wherever the evidence takes me. I'm sure that I might personally hope it comes out a certain way, but I won't make it come out that way. And you're right. I've never revealed what I believe in any of my books.
I was under the impression that the E and J sources, the earliest sources from the Old Testament, came out of this culture, the early Jewish culture, which was still had some polytheistic paganism residual stuff that was tied up in it. And then as Judaism matured and progressed and they got priests and stuff like that, then that's when the priestly source, the P source, came about. And that's the source that contributed all of the laws and regulations, like what you could eat. And if you were going to eat meat, you had to sacrifice it at this altar and so forth. And then the D source, the Deuteronomical source, came about in opposition to the P source. And that's why everything it says is in opposition to P. And it's kind of paying homage to E and J, their roots. Is that more or less right?
That's fair, but simplified.
Simplified.
If anybody would then start reading carefully into all the
minutia
elements. Yeah, it's J and E are the two earliest prose texts. There are parts of the Bible that are older than that.
Okay.
Like the Song of Miriam in Exodus and the Song of Deborah in Judges are the two oldest things in the Bible. And they're still poetry, not prose yet. And then, but these are these oldest long prose sources. And then they got combined. And then the priestly source, right, came along as an alternative to them. That's what's so amazing. The author of P, he didn't like what he read. The author of P was a priest in Jerusalem. The Jerusalem priesthood saw themselves as descendants of Aaron, the first high priest of Israel. And in the J.E. text, Aaron is the guy who makes the golden calf.
And Aaron is Moses' brother.
Yeah, and in those original two texts, he was not Moses' brother. The priestly text changed him. They upgraded him to Moses' brother and said he was the elder brother. So he was the firstborn too.
Interesting.
So they wrote some critical texts about Moses. The J and E texts had some very obviously critical texts of Aaron. So what you're getting is
a rivalry.
Dueling Bibles here. Yeah. And it was one of the great ironies of the whole history of literature that some editor came along and put those together.
Yeah, and that's kind of the whole irony of it, that you know, you hear when people are kind of talking against the Bible as a book with no validity at all, they kind of play up all of the inconsistencies and the contradictions. And a lot of those inconsistencies and contradictions makes a lot of sense when you realize that, you know, oh, well, this part of the Old Testament was written by a tribe whose leader was Aaron, and that's why Aaron is being more favored. And this part of the Bible was written by a tribe who was led by Moses, and that's why Moses is played up. And then eventually they all had to get edited together so they didn't kill each other, because they all had to cohabitate.
Yeah, in a way, the editor fooled us all, because when you read the New Testament, it also begins with four sources, but they're Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they're four separate Gospels. And you understand there's four different versions by four different people, and you read them, and every Christian makes his or her peace with where they're the same or different or whatever. But in the Old Testament, they took the four sources and they intertwined them around each other. Like
right.
The strands of a DNA molecule, you know.
Instead of having one chunk from this source and another story from this source, they're all kind of edited together line by line. You've actually got your own translation of the Bible called The Bible with Sources, right?
It's called The Bible with Sources Revealed. And there it's a translation of the five books of Moses with different colors and fonts so you can see which is which.
That's pretty cool. I've actually been wanting to check that one out. I haven't read that one yet, but that's a longer read, obviously. So, you know, there's people that say, well, the Semitic languages had no vowels, so how can we trust that those are accurate translations in English, which is a very sophisticated language?
Well, even though the vowels weren't originally written, it's like in English, if you read something in shorthand and you know how shorthand works,
right,
you can read it even with a lot of letters missing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you grow up with Hebrew your whole life, and if you've read a lot of Hebrew, then, yeah, if you see a word without the vowels, you can manage. And it works to this day. I mean, if you're in modern Israel, read an Israeli newspaper, there's no vowels. They're still doing it that way. And the people do get the news there. And every now and then, right, people make a funny mistake in the Bible, and sometimes a verb, you can't tell if it's active or passive. So you go, John shot Bill, or John was shot by Bill, and they look the same.
Right.
But so you have to figure them out. But we also have the Greek, which is a very early translation. And now we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, which have some variations of words. So we're able to figure out the vowels. And we have comparative Semitic. So we have other ancient Near Eastern languages like Akkadian, which did represent vowel sounds, and Ugaritic, which represented some vowel sounds. So yeah, it's a puzzle, but that puzzle's been put together, I would say, mostly.
Could it be said there's a link between the idea that we're all God, God manifested in three dimensions, like the concept that humans are connected and that we all have creative control over our thoughts and abilities, and we're a unique animal in that way, and that's such a similar idea to the name Yahweh, which means I am.
It's a little more nuanced than that. The name Yahweh is the third person masculine singular. So it's not that it means I am. It's when in that passage in Exodus chapter 3, when God introduces himself to Moses, God explains the name Yahweh by saying, I am what I am. And a lot of stupid Popeye jokes about that. But he then is doing it to explain the name Yahweh, which would have to mean either he is or he causes to be, which would make more sense for a creator God. So it is interesting that the name of God has to do with being. The names of almost all the other gods you can think of from the ancient world are nouns, but the name Yahweh is a verb. It's very rare that a person's name is a verb. And of all verbs, it's the verb to be. And you go, well, what does that mean? That means like everything.
Yeah.
So
it's a little confusing, God.
Yeah. So when he says, when Moses says, well, I have to tell the children of Israel, what's the name of this God who sent me? What should I tell them? What's your name? And God says, I am what I am, and Yahweh sent me, and it means he causes to be. And Moses goes, no, really.
I feel like I am that I am is like what Jay-Z would say if he was God or something. It's like something you'd hear a rapper say. I am that I am.
Yeah.
In the Exodus, you spent some time talking about the plagues that affected the Egyptians when Moses was trying to convince the Pharaoh to let the Israelites go. And I thought it was interesting how you suggested that people who try to explain these stories scientifically in a way to kind of like disarm them. And you kind of say how this isn't really contributing to the argument at all.
Well, if you're going to start saying they made up stuff, then why not just say they made up the whole thing anyway? Then you don't need the eclipse.
Right.
So people do this thing that's sort of trying to apologize for the miracles of the Bible, where they find this middle ground. And I just never bought it, even since I was a kid. If you believe in the miracles and you think it was a miracle, fine. If you don't believe in miracles and you think it's just a story, fine. But this is this middle ground that's saying, no, it something happened, but they were too dumb to realize what it was, or their authors were too dishonest to tell what it was, so they upped the ante a little and made it miraculous. I just don't see how you gain anything by doing that game.
I think people are probably not out to just bash the Bible altogether, but I think there's a genuine interest, and there's been a genuine interest for me to kind of explain some of that stuff as somebody who has questions about it and doesn't really know what information is out there for us to understand. At some point, you step back and you go, these arguments aren't really helping anybody, because this is either totally bullshit or it's totally something else.
Yeah, I'd rather just go at each section and see what I can establish. As far as the Exodus goes, you know, I guess I'd be considered a conservative because I think the Exodus happened. And then others say, no, he's one of those crazy liberals because I don't think it happened exactly the way it's described in the text. I think it was much smaller and just involved the Levites. So some people put me down for being a liberal and others put me down for being a conservative. So I guess that's a compliment.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. You get along with everybody and you piss everybody off at the same time.
Yeah. Either it means I'm enlightened or I'm just unprincipled. Yeah. But anyway, I do think the Exodus is historical. But if you ask me, do I think that the world began with two naked people, a magic tree, and a talking snake? Well, no. So where I have evidence that something happened, I tell it. And the beginning of this book says, if you're a person of faith, this book isn't about your faith. If you're a person of reason and intellect, this isn't about your intellect. This is more like start out with your gut. What does your gut tell you? Something happened 3,000 years ago or it didn't. And now let's go look at all the evidence. And at the end, you'll say, okay, the evidence persuaded me or it didn't persuade me. I'm persuaded. It happened. And it made a difference to now, to this minute.
The Exodus is an important event because and it's probably the reason you've chosen to write your entire follow-up book on the subject, but it's important because the first five books of the Bible, I kind of wish it was called the Bible. It actually is called the Bible in the part of the country I grew up in. But the Exodus is an important event because it's a huge beat point in the story of, the Jews and how their story began. So it is important. And your writing is, you know, I haven't finished your book on the Exodus yet, but I've
kind of given away a lot of chapter five, which is that monotheism goes all the way back to the Exodus, not what people have always thought, which is that it's much later. And the last chapter, which is crucial to me, is that it gave birth to caring about aliens, strangers, foreigners. And it's this extraordinary thing that 52 times in the five books of Moses, it says you shall have the same law, one law for the alien and for the citizen. Older Bibles, like since the King James, would say one law for the stranger and the citizen. It's the same word. It means like a resident alien. So, you know, a Frenchman is living in the United States. It's a foreigner. But a Frenchman who gets in trouble in Georgia is supposed to have the same protections in court. And if I sue him, the court has to judge us fairly. And that's already biblical. And it wasn't anywhere else in the ancient Near East that I know of. In the other ancient Near Eastern law codes, it's not that they were unethical and immoral and all. The pagan world cared about treating widows and orphans fairly and being kind to the poor and all that sort of thing. But none of them have a law that says you have to treat a foreigner the same as a local. And that it does that 52 times. And the strange thing is four of those four sources that you're talking about, E, J, P, and D, three out of the four were written by Levites, who, you know, are the ones I'm saying were in Egypt. And the fourth one, J, was not written by a Levite. And these 52 times that it says you have to be kind to aliens occur only in E, P, and D, the three Levite sources. and the fourth one never mentions it. So those three sources, they say you have to be kind to aliens, and they and four different places they say why? Because you were an alien in Egypt. So if this is right, it means that that experience of that group of people, however many of them there were, 3,300, 3,400 years ago, impacted to this day a notion that's American too, and other countries, that you don't treat somebody differently because he's an alien. And, you know, I didn't write the book with any attempt to get into the contemporary politics. And it's obvious everybody knows there's big issues about aliens now, legal aliens, illegal aliens.
Timing is really interesting.
Yeah. And that's that. If that's good for the book sales, I suppose my publisher will be happy. But my point of view was not to score any points. I make no references to any of the current politics in the book. I'm a Bible scholar, not a politician. And I'm just recognizing that the Bible was the first source to make this amazing thing that to this day you treat everybody as yourself. I mean, it says in Leviticus 19, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There's one of the most famous lines in the Bible. It's quoted in the New Testament too. Jesus makes it one of the two commandments that matter the most. You love your neighbor as yourself. And then a lot of people have claimed that the word for neighbor there doesn't really mean everybody. It just means a member of your own group. And that's absolutely wrong. I checked everywhere where the word occurs in the Bible. The word means everybody. And if there's any doubt, then a few verses later in the same chapter, Leviticus 19, it says, you shall love the alien as yourself. So there's no question about it. That they were saying you don't exclude, you include. That's amazing. And I don't ignore the bad parts of the Bible too. I understand, you know, wipe out the Canaanites, defeat the Amalekites, kill the Midianites. I mean, I understand that there's stories about battles and horrible catastrophic things too. And it's okay for people to point those out. But they have to recognize if you're going to do that, if you're going to cherry pick the bad passages in the Bible, you have to at least acknowledge to everybody that you're cherry picking. The overwhelming, much larger context is like 52 times it's telling you treat aliens the same as you treat your brother. And that's a big deal. To me, it's extraordinary. And I'm glad that the book goes out on that.
It is a very hot button issue, and you know, it's a complicated one because it's not just an issue of morality. It's also, you know, politics are complicated, and that stuff is way beyond my pay grade, so I'm not even going to weigh in on it. But you know, what I love about what you're saying is that this is not a new conversation. We've been talking about this stuff since literally the beginning of time, and that's what I love about quantum theory, because it suggests we're all the same energy. You know, we're all connected. We're literally the same thing. And whether you're religious or not, that's a great place to hang the hat of the golden rule on.
I understand that it's human nature to be suspicious of people who are different who show up. And so...
Were you suspicious of me when I showed up today in your front yard?
Absolutely. I checked you out online first. I said, oh yeah, that's the guy I saw in the YouTubes.
Right? And you had the audacity to actually let me into your front door.
Yeah. We're going to count the silverware at the end of this.
That's amazing. Wow. Yeah, that is really fascinating about the immigrant stuff. I hadn't even thought about the parallels there.
Well, the Bible stopped me on that point.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't go, you know, I'm going to go looking for some nice, liberal, love your neighbor stuff in the Bible. I mean, you know, the love your neighbor was there long before I came along.
Yeah.
You know, and I mentioned, it's the only time I've mentioned you something and I told you the actual chapter number where it occurs. That's Leviticus 19. And that's because I tell my students this, one of those stupid things. I say, well, you're on a desert island and you can only take one chapter of the Bible with you. What would it be? And I don't think most people would pick Leviticus 19, but I would, because it's got all different kinds of laws in it. Laws you'd like, laws you wouldn't like, laws that are ritual things and about sacrificial stuff and all, and then laws about how to treat other people. And all. It's got everything. It's moral, it's ritual, it's everything. And it's almost dead center of the five books of Moses. And right there, it has this, you know, love your neighbor as yourself and even love an alien as yourself. It's too perfect.
Now, what are these two books you've got here in front of me? What is this? What's this one here? I know what this one is because I'm reading it, the Exodus, but what's this guy?
Oh, that's the Bible in Hebrew.
The Bible in Hebrew.
Good, take a look.
This is pretty, I've actually never seen this.
Yeah.
Biblia Hebraica?
Yes, for some reason they put the title of it in Latin and you just opened it from the left, but it's a Hebrew Bible, so it opens
From the right, of course. I never even thought about that. That makes total sense. You read this book backwards. Can't even read
it. No, we're reading all the other books backwards.
Yeah, that's true.
We're reading English backwards.
Yeah. I'm actually doing zero reading because I can't read Hebrew, so I'm going to put this book down. One of the things that really does stand out to me is the notion that we should love everyone as ourselves. So, I mean, what do you make of you as a scholar and someone who is very intimate with these old writings? What do you make of some of these crazy old laws? Some of them in Leviticus, where your favorite passage is. Mm. There are some very strange laws that don't seem applicable to today at all, and a lot of them really just aren't. But I mean, what do we do with some of that stuff?
Well, a lot of it needn't be an issue anymore. All the laws having to do with sacrifice of animals and incense burning and all that, most of the temple law, which is a very high percentage of the laws of the five books of Moses, can't be practiced because the last temple was in Jerusalem and was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. So you can't do sacrifice anymore. Jews haven't done sacrifice since then. Samaritans still do. Christians and Muslims don't. So those ritual laws that were specifically related to the existence of a temple don't exist anymore. I mean, local synagogues and churches are not the temple. It was just the one temple where that applied. So the rest of the laws, a lot of them you like, because it says love your neighbor and love the alien and all that, terrific. And things like being kind to your enemy. If it says if you see your enemy's ox go astray, you got to help him get it back. Things like that. Laws of war that are not perfect, but also, you know, you have to give a city an opportunity for peace when you besiege it. And if they say yes, then you leave them. You can conquer them, you can make them serve you, but you can't just go in and massacre them. Most important in biblical laws of war, you're not allowed to rape the women of the losing side. I mean, that's what happens in war. One of the functions of war is the women get raped. And biblical law is if you see a woman and she's attractive, you have to take her home, give her 30 days to mourn anyone in her family who was killed in the war. And then you can marry her or you can let her go and you have no other choice. You can't enslave her. You can't sell her. None of that. It's still not ideal. You can't, you know, if you want to marry her, she has no say in it. So, right, laws, especially ones relating to women, might not fit a lot of contemporary standards. But for the most part, they were the beginning of a revolution that's only, you know, reached a certain level in our day, and we're still not quite there, but it was the beginning of that. And there are laws about homosexuality and other things that are contemporary, terribly important issues to us, where people are struggling with the laws of homosexuality. But I wrote a book about this stuff too. I picked five controversial issues of the Bible. My last book was called The Bible Now. And it had abortion, homosexuality, women's rights, the earth, and capital punishment. So I picked five soft little controversial.
That was an uphill battle.
So I thought that was going to be like my biggest selling book ever. And it was actually my worst selling book. I think because I tried to be even-handed on all of them. And so a lot of reviews complimented the book for not taking an obvious side. But I was told by a very smart literary agent that that's publishing suicide. Nobody wants to read an even-handed book on abortion or homosexuality. They want to read a book that says that their side is right.
Right.
So that's going nowhere, but at least I tried.
That's the epitome of the breakdown between the world of academia and the world of marketing.
Yeah.
How does someone like you, you know, you're so in touch with this old book and you clearly have convictions that come from it. So how do you reconcile your worldview with the worldview of the people who wrote it? Obviously, the people who wrote the Bible were, you know, they lived a long time ago. They had a very specific idea of God that led them to do everything they did. They were violent. They had weird laws. And it wasn't all bad. But, you know, how do you reconcile that? What do you do with that? And, that was a loaded question.
Okay, look, I hate authors who do this, who say, well, read my book. I wrote a book called The Disappearance of God.
Okay.
In paperback, the same book had a different title. It's called The Hidden Face of God. So I want everybody to know they don't have to buy both books. They're word for word the same book. And
very clever.
That was the one place where I tried to lay out my understanding of God, of the understanding of God, of people's perception of God. So I haven't met God. I don't know what God is. But so it's about how we've portrayed God, how we related to God. So the first section of the book is about the Bible, where God becomes more and more hidden in the Bible. Like, you know, in Genesis chapter 1, it's all God. He's all over the place. At the end of the Old Testament, in the book of Esther, God isn't mentioned. And then new things happen in the New Testament. God comes back in a new form, but God is killed. But he outsmarts us. He resurrects us because, you know, you don't get to be God without being smart. The next section of the book is about Nietzsche and Dostoevsky and the whole notion of death of God. And the last section of the book is called Big Bang and Kabbalah, where I'm looking at some extraordinary convergences of mystical religion with contemporary physics, where I didn't try to do some dumb, oh yeah, look at this, it's just like Big Bang. But there are some things that are remarkably like Big Bang. And I did, in fact, consult with Walter Cohn, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, and James Hartle, who did the work on the full space-time thing together with Hawking. So I did the best I could in fields where I'm not expert to try to make some sense of where somebody might go with that now. When I say, well, I don't tell people what I believe in, the closest one could get, my most personal book would be that one, The Disappearance of God. So
I'll have to check that one out.
Yeah. I'm sorry. It sounds like I'm trying to sell you all my books today. But
so would you say, we've talked a lot about the Old Testament and where a lot of the ideas in the Bible came from, where they originated. Is it accurate to call the early parts of the Jewish religion pagan? You kind of corrected me on that earlier when we were talking about that. Is that an accurate depiction of it or not?
I think the honest answer is yes and no. I mean, in the earliest stages, ancient Israelites believed in El and other gods, the whole pantheon of the gods, and El was the chief god. And when the identification of El and Yahweh as the same god happened, that may have meant monotheism, or maybe it just meant that they had one chief god, but they still had the rest of the pantheon. That chapter that we didn't talk about in this book, chapter 5, is how they gradually developed that and got it down to one. And the key I can give away to everybody, the book is written like a detective. I write that way. So it's written like a nonfiction detective mystery.
It really does feel like that reading it.
That's intentional. I read a lot of detective fiction and I derivative,
all right.
I copy.
I'm figuring out all your secrets.
Yeah. But the key piece of evidence there is Psalm 82, which you can just read it and you'll see it's God condemns all the other gods to death. And they had a notion that there used to be gods, and now there aren't anymore. And that was Israel's own myth of how we got from there, our early days, where our ancestors believed in the gods, to our days where we finally stopped that. And they needed that so that when a little girl says, in whatever generation it is, what do you think, it's the 8th century, the 5th century, whenever it was that the overwhelming majority of the Jews said, okay, there's one God, and they bought monotheism. But in that first generation, they must have been little kids who looked at their mothers and said, well, mommy, grandma believed in lots of gods. Was grandma bad? Now, what are you supposed to answer that?
Grandma's in hell.
She didn't give it. She cut me out of her will.
I hope you hugged her goodbye.
No, let's say, no, grandma wasn't bad. The gods were bad. And so the one God condemned them, and they eventually became mortal like humans. It's explicit in Psalm 82. It says, like a human, you will die. It's those words exactly. And that may be the answer to the old classic question. People say, well, why does God speak in the plural sometimes in the Bible? And God says in Genesis chapter 1, let us create humans in our image. And in the Garden of Eden, God says, the human has become like one of us, knowing good and bad. And in the story of the Tower of Babel in chapter 11 of Genesis, it says, God says, let us go down and confuse their languages there. And people say, oh, well, why is God speaking in the plural there? Is it the plural of majesty? Is it, you know, whatever? It's nonsense. If you look, those three examples I gave you are the only three examples in the Bible. So that's all just in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. For the whole rest of the Bible, God doesn't speak in the plural. And you're like, well, why does God only speak in the plural at the beginning? Because in their mythology and their theology, only in the beginning was there anybody to talk to.
Right. Because they believed in lots of gods at the beginning.
At the beginning. That's okay. Why in the book of Job, God has a whole assembly of gods, because that takes place early and they're still the gods. But by the end of the Exodus story, all the Egyptian gods, all the Babylonian, all the gods were understood by Israel to be dead.
Okay, so the early Jewish faith was originally more open, and it was even polytheistic, and it got more sophisticated once the P-source came along, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so is your view that the P-source was helpful?
I think the P-source is not necessarily...
And the P-source is the priestly source, the source that came much later and added all the laws and regulations and stuff, right?
Yeah, the author of the text of P, that guy wrote Genesis chapter 1, the seven-day creation story, person wrote a flood story. That person wrote the story about the covenant between God and Abraham. That person was one of the authors of the Exodus.
This is all the P source.
Yeah.
The priestly source.
It's the entire book of Leviticus, all those laws. So it's a priest writing the way a priest sees things. And but because he's later than those earlier sources, J and E, does not mean he's more sophisticated or something like that. I don't go for those ideas that, you know, we're more sophisticated than people 100 years ago. We're just technologically ahead of them.
And I guess that's all I meant. Not that they were more sophisticated, like smarter, but just that Judaism would have progressed and become more intricate and, you know, like a real institution, that maybe they were trying to systematically encourage people to think a certain way because they had to make everybody get along.
There had always been two countries, Judah and Israel. If you're from Judah, you're a Jew. If you're from Israel, you're an Israelite. But by the time the priestly source was written, Israel had been defeated by the Assyrians. It was wiped out. We call it the 10 lost tribes of Israel to this day. They were just merged.
They were scattered.
But yeah. Probably they had just moved south to Judah because it was next to each other. I mean, the whole region we're talking about is smaller than Georgia. I mean, it's not, you know, you could walk it. And they were now one smaller country. No longer Israel and Judah, but just Judah with one king, when before there'd been one king in Israel and a different king in Judah. So they're competing, sometimes fighting each other, sometimes cooperating. So the priestly writer is writing in a different world. Yeah, he's got a different reality to come to terms with. And that is
more. And maybe more people to reconcile.
Yeah. He's got a population of people who used to be all separate, and now they're all living next door to each other. Yeah.
Now they've got to all get along.
Yeah. And he's the guy who writes Love Your Neighbor as Yourself. So, yeah.
It's kind of funny how the Bible gets this really bad rap of being this divisive, segregatory book. But it's actually very inclusive. And, you know, I think that's probably just because of how most people read it today. They don't know where it came from. But I don't know anyone that would that disagrees with the notion that you should love your neighbor as yourself.
You might be right that everybody would agree, yeah, you're supposed to love your neighbor, but they just disagree about who's your neighbor. I mean,
yep.
If he's a different race from you, if he's a different religion from you, if he's a different country from you, well. So all I can say is that biblically it meant everybody. There is no distinction. There's no racism. They have wars with other countries, but they don't hate them. They don't even hate pagans. In biblical law, if a Greek wants to worship Zeus, there's nothing in the Bible saying he can't. Israelites, Jews, are not allowed to worship Zeus because then they're going against their own religion. But they have nothing against pagans for being pagans. When they attack the Canaanites, for example, it's for issues they present. They say they're moral issues, that the things they did that they thought was immoral and stuff. But it's not for worshiping other gods. They have nothing against people worshiping other gods. It's really remarkably ecumenical, the Bible, for a book that's often accused of being the opposite. People say, well, monotheism is worse than pagan religion because when you have only one God, well, if you really believe in your only one God, well, then everybody else must be wrong. And so they say monotheistic religions are more likely to do devastating wars and genocides and so on. And I see the logic of that argument, but it just doesn't happen to fit the evidence. It's just not true. If you look at the record of what pagan nations did and what monotheistic nations did, they're both been pretty horrible at times. I wouldn't want to get into the debate of who has a worse record, you know, overall.
Yeah, that wouldn't be helpful. Another argument to that could be that, well, there is only one God, and whether or not people know it, they're all worshiping the same one, which is an option, but that also has its own implications and problems that come along with it.
Yeah, and you have to believe that one God exists.
Yeah, exactly.
Remember, you and I haven't admitted that yet.
I think it's unfortunate that so many people get so set into the idea of God being exactly what they think about when they think about it, that their idea is right. Because, you know, God is supposed to be incomprehensible. It's like, you know, how could you ever put a box around that? Of course, it's going to be full of surprises. If God exists, he arguably exists in some higher dimension. He doesn't exist in a three-dimensional world with height, width, and depth. We know that because we don't perceive him in that world. So if he exists, it exists in a higher plane, you know, beyond our five senses. And the idea of dimensions is hard for a lot of people to get their heads around. But, you know, it's easy when you think about comparing the complexity of our three-dimensional world to the simplicity of a two-dimensional cartoon. Like, for example, like a cartoon person couldn't have a digestive tract because it would literally just cut the person in half. So, you know, the depth dimension for us allows us to digest food and amongst other things. And the craziest part is we have 11 theoretical dimensions, not just four, according to quantum theory. And we need each of these dimensions to make sense of why things in the subatomic level react the way that they do. They react unpredictably. And the only, you know, the only way we can account for this is by saying that there's, you know, higher planes, because that's just what appears to be happening when we test them. But this drove Einstein nuts to his grave, because it meant that, you know, a lot of the stuff that he said was wrong, but also that we may not ever figure it out. And so, you know, I just think that God and science are totally compatible ideas. And, you know, I'm sorry I'm talking so much here, but I'll go off on this. The idea of gender, which is what we were specifically talking about. God having a gender is hilarious because in the Bible, he does have gender. Thinking of this from the perspective of people, a man needs a woman to create a human, but God doesn't. God just creates humans out of thin air, right? And God is a man, though. And this is confusing because it implies that God is incomplete. It's a polytheistic thought, arguably, or at least duotheistic.
Well, very interesting. Yeah, originally gods all had to have sex. They had to be male or female. And when you get down to one, it changed everything. And it's interesting that Judaism, once it did give up the goddess completely.
Yeah, Judaism had a goddess. When was it that they gave that up?
Well, in the book of Jeremiah, so there you're around later than 600 BCE, you're in the high 500s BCE, you've got Jeremiah criticizing the people for worshiping the Queen of Heaven. Mm-hmm. And in addition to God, they believe he has an Asherah, a goddess, a wife. And we've found archaeologically, we've found references to Yahweh and his Asherah, which is Yahweh and his, you know, girlfriend, wife, whatever she, I don't know if they got married, because who would perform the ceremony?
That's a good question.
Yes. So
that's not an easy license to get.
Do you go to the minister, the priest, or the rabbi who does the ceremony? But anyway, once Judaism got rid of that, then this concept later developed of the divine presence, which the Hebrew word for this is Shekhinah, which is a feminine word for the presence of God. And that word never occurs in the Bible, but it does come up in post-biblical Judaism, and especially in the medieval world. And at the same time that apparently the concept of the Shekhinah was developing in Judaism, that's when Mariology became really important in Catholicism. So it seems like we need the feminine somewhere in religion, because it is half of the world, you know?
Yeah.
So giving up that part of pagan religion may have been the hardest part of the whole thing. Making the transition to one meant making the transition out of divine sex. I mean, originally you had gods and goddesses, so all gods were either male or female. So then when they got it down to just one, it was the male one. And so to this day, when most people say God, whether they admit it or not, they're thinking male. We conceive of God much more as a father than as a mother, as a king than a queen. It's even those of us like me, like I'm cool. I'm okay. I don't call God male or female. I had that girlfriend who fixed me up on that, but I still know that somewhere in our heads, you know, I'm enough of a Freudian to know that God is our father, you know, in our somewhere deep in our psyche, more often than it's our mother. And so, yeah, they saw God as a guy. It was a natural step, and now we're in this step where humans are starting to say more and more, no, God's not a guy. God is God, and there's only one. So if there's only one of something, what meaning would sex have anyway? I mean, you can...
Right. There would be no reason to even have words for... There would be no words for sex or male or female. It would be no reason to differentiate.
Yeah. You can't get away that they thought God was male. In biblical times, I mean, the name is Yahweh. Yahweh is a very masculine name. It's like Robert or Richard. But but anyone who knows Hebrew knows that the first letter is a masculine verbal form. If it were feminine, it would be Tawah. And whenever God has a consort, it's a female consort. Yeah. So, so that was their conception. It isn't necessarily ours.
So it seems like what we have with the Bible is a book that has been through a lot of hands, but has a consistent universal message that everyone can pull something from, everyone can learn something from. And, loving your neighbor it can be a challenge, especially in a world like today where there's a lot of different beliefs on who is your neighbor and how we should be getting along with people based on who's trying to move into your country and what that means for your economy and yada, yada, yada. It's getting pretty complicated in our world today. But I guess it's fair to say that if you set out to just love everybody and realize that we're all kind of connected and we all share awareness and consciousness, we're all in this thing together. And, I can't remember if this is biblical or not, but the whole idea of a house divided against itself cannot stand. That is, I definitely believe that. And I think we're kind of witnessing that on planet Earth right now. You know, we're seeing a bunch of people kind of arguing about how we're going to get along in a finite amount of space. And I think we all could stand to remember that we're all neighbors.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's that Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. And
never heard that.
That's us.
Maybe I'd prefer to live in an uninteresting time.
Well, you don't get to choose.
I guess that's true. I guess they're all interesting times because it's constantly evolving and what we know about what we know is changing and kind of keeps it all interesting, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, Richard, Dick, thank you so much for having me today in
thank
your home.
You. This has been great.
Has it been fun? Is there anything that I've left out that maybe you wish we would have covered?
I'm actually really happy. I hope you're happy with this.
Pretty good conversation.
Thanks for coming. Come back.
I will. Maybe we'll do a part 2.
All right.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I want to hear your thoughts on this conversation. Drop me a line in the comments section. Let me know what you're thinking. Or if it's long, shoot me an email. hello@spellboundshow.com. I just love talking to Dick about this stuff because, first of all, he's just a wealth of information, but he never makes you feel pressured with the information he presents. He just lets you know what is there, and he lets you decide what to do. He's not taking obvious sides, and what more could you want? I mean, where else can you find people like Dick that know all this stuff and then they don't use it against you? That's something that's missing in the religious debate right now, and that's what this whole podcast is about. Not religion specifically, but just the open-minded conversation. Our world is a giant melting pot right now, and we got to figure out better ways to talk about our differences. This could get really bad. Think about it. If we don't find more amicable ways to talk about this, you got the Christians saying homosexuals are going to burn forever in hell. You got the Muslims strapping bombs to themselves and walking into public. You got Sam Harris saying the only answer is militant atheism. That's definitely not going to help. Think about that. That's crazy. This is getting really, really out of hand, and I just think we all could stand to have a little open-minded, peaceful conversation about these topics. They're high-pressure topics. People wrap their entire identity around these topics. Religion deserves to be treated with respectful conversation, and that's what I am hoping to facilitate here. I hope you found this interesting. Maybe we'll explore the Bible more. Maybe we'll just explore other religious books. Who knows? You tell me what you want to hear, and I'll go out and find it. Next week, we're talking to... Wow, I just talked about violence and bombs. I got to change the subject. Next week, we're talking to Andrew Rader about flat earth, how to disarm a flat earther in conversation. More specifically, we all want to know how to silence these people. I'm joking. Some of these people are very dear to me. But, it's a fascinating topic. And Andrew is a mission manager at SpaceX. He has his PhD from MIT in human spaceflight. He's got a lot of interesting things to say. Who knows? Maybe he'll try to tell you should be a flat earther. Guess you'll have to tune in next week to find out. This has been Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith. I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. And looking forward to next week. Guys, take care of yourselves.